This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 28th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Samaritz with me, Tyler Brulé, Marcus Hippie and Sophie Grove. Coming up over the next 60 minutes,
we sit down with Carl Elsener, CEO and head of family business Victorinox, to discuss the Swiss Army Knives brand outlook for the future as it diversifies its products.
We also head to Basel to the centenary birthday of one of the great names of furniture, Ray Eames, and assess her influence on the world of mountain design.
Charles and Ray Eames were very, very important to Vitra, and they are very much on our minds, both in terms of figures, but also their product is still a very important part of our production. And it's one of the miracles that 50 years later, it's still modern.
And it's soon time for one of the most exciting sporting activities here in the Engadine, the White Turf Race across the Lake of Samaritz. We'll sit down with the Secretary General, Elizabeth Zindel, to find out what it takes to organize a horse race on a frozen lake.
And we also learn how to make a beautiful plate of cannedeli, classic Tyrolean dumpling. And our teacher will be Michelin star chef Norbert Niedergoffler.
So now we're making the dumplings. First we start to make them round like the usual dumplings. And then we make them flat like a hamburger. We put it in a pan with some butter. We saute them from both sides. Then we take them out and then we cook them in salted water.
Plus, we'll welcome our hosts, Marcus and Marinda Hauser, too. Lots still to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
And good evening. For this very last weekend of 2012, we are in our little perch. It's not a very high perch, but it's a good perch right in front of the roundabout here in Samaritz. And we have a very buzzy Friday night après ski crowd across the way as we're sitting here on the terrace at Hauser. Now, I have to ask you, I did tell our listeners early in the day, you were heading off to the neighboring village, Celerina, to go and visit the local Salvation Army. Not really, well, it was charity. It sort of sounds like you're going to be baking and handing out things, but you're just sort of buying, weren't you, Sophie?
Well, it is quite an unusual spot. It's so amazing because we were escorted by your mother, who happens to have a very good eye for these things.
She's got a good in with that particular branch of the Salvation Army.
She has. I've never seen anyone negotiate in a Salvation Army before, but she did, because the hoard we got was quite considerable, more or less their whole fur section, plus some amazing vintage pieces of furniture were bought.
Amazing indeed. I haven't seen anyone being that excited for a long time as our Sophie Grove in that place. It's kind of a secret, but do you want to give us an idea of how much you actually end up shopping over there?
No, why don't you keep everyone in suspense for a moment? We're going to head back to London very quickly. Jonathan Wheatley is there with the news.
The former South African President Nelson Mandela is doing well today after being discharged from hospital. The iconic statesman was admitted to a Pretoria hospital on the 8th of December, and this was his longest stay in hospital since he was released from prison back in 1990. However, government spokesman Mac Maharaj said Mandela hadn't fully recovered.
The doctors yesterday came to the conclusion that he had made sufficient progress to be able to be discharged. Nonetheless, he still will receive home-based high care so that he recovers fully. He is not yet fully recovered, but he is sufficiently moved forward so that he can be discharged.
Another former president is now in hospital. Egypt's 84-year-old Hosni Mubarak, ousted last year after 30 years in power, was transferred to an army hospital from his prison clinic after fracturing a rib in a recent fall. Mubarak, who is serving a life sentence for his role in killing protesters during a revolt last year, will stay in the army hospital for a fortnight, 2 weeks, after his health deteriorated. The Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has today pledged stringent action against perpetrators who brutally assaulted a 23-year-old medical student in a moving bus in New Delhi before throwing her half-naked outside. Sonia Gandhi, the head of the ruling Congress Party, also promised swift action against the six perpetrators.
Our thoughts are with the young woman who is fighting for her life after the barbarous attack on her. Our only wish today is that she recovers and that she comes back to us, and that no time is lost in bringing the perpetrators of such barbarous act to justice.
The Spanish Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, has today said that he didn't rule out asking for help from the European Central Bank's bond-buying programme, but said Spain didn't expect to have to ask for aid for now. Rajoy said ECB President Mario Draghi's bond-buying plan had a calming effect on markets after a tumultuous year. President Barack Obama and congressional leaders are meeting today for the first time since November, with no sign of progress in resolving their differences over the federal budget and low expectations for a so-called fiscal cliff deal before the 1st of January. The Senate Majority Leader, Democrat Harry Reid, laid the blame for Republican intransigence on raising taxes.
The only people in America who don't think taxes should be raised on the rich are the Republicans who work in this building. So anytime the Speaker and the Republican leader come to the President and say, we've got a deal for you, the President's door is always open, and mine is too.
And finally, the Nature Conservancy of Canada has launched a fundraising program in the east of the country to help moose find their way to some cross-border love. The program, dubbed the Moose Sex Project, is aiming to raise $35,000 Canadian dollars to buy a narrow strip of land between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. Creating a corridor for wildlife may allow more of New Brunswick's moose population to cross over to Nova Scotia and find mates. The moose in Nova Scotia have been endangered since 2003, and the Conservancy hopes that by creating that love corridor for them between the provinces, it will help preserve the declining moose population there. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. Sounds like an absolute snip, $35,000 Canadian dollars. I think they should expand it across the border into the United States and share the love all across North America. It's just 3:06 in Niseko in Japan right now. It's 19:06 here in St. Moritz. It's 13:06 in Stowe-Vermont. It's 10:06 in Whistler, British Columbia. You're listening to Midori House. We're live in St. Moritz. We're back in a moment. And welcome back to Midori House. We are live from the center of St. Moritz with me, Tyler Brûlé, Marcus Hippie, and Sophie Grove. Now, just before we went to the news, Marcus, you posed a question to our Sophie Grove about her rather particular, if not slightly peculiar, haul at the Salvation Army or the Heils Armee over in the next town in Celladina.
Tell us, Sophie.
Well, my most favorite find was a pair of amazing ice skates, sort of vintage 80s, but they're figure skating, beautiful skates. Your mum inspected them. She ran her finger down the blade to check if it was good enough.
They probably need a sharpening tomorrow, though, anyway, don't they?
They might do. And then I'm going to take to the lake next to the hotel, possibly any lake that I see in the next the coming years. Now I'm the proud owner of those skates.
I don't know if you saw on the lake today, there was a man whizzing around on a snowmobile, and I guess he is preparing for one of the events which we're going to be covering, I believe, shortly in this program. We're going to be talking about the white turf. So I wasn't sure if he was actually sort of flattening it out for the upcoming white turf because of all the snow, but also they tend to launch the fireworks for New Year's Eve. Those are also done for the lake as well. So it could have been fireworks preparation at the same time.
It's incredibly interesting. I already had a discussion today on how you make sure that when you organize an event like white turf on a frozen lake, how do you make sure that all the thousands of people watching the occasion, all the horses, all the constructions just don't go into the water so the ice won't break?
Well, it is quite amazing because it is a real feat of Swiss engineering, because it's not just a bunch of people rock up for an afternoon and then some horses go galloping along. But, you know, there's quite massive and serious construction going on because, you know, they erect these enormous tents, bleachers, all kinds of things, mini boutiques and whatnot. And then, as you said, there's thousands of spectators and cars and then all these horses thumping along.
It sounds Elizabethan. I think they used to do that thing on the Thames.
Yeah, no, it is vaguely like that. Also coming up a little bit later on the program as well, we're going to be talking to the CEO of Victorinox. Mr. Carl Elsner is here. He's just down the valley. We're going to be jumping over to Basel, as Marcus was saying a little bit earlier. We're talking about the 100th birthday of Ray Eames, and of course the link there to Basel and Weil am Rhein, of course, is Vitra, who are the manufacturers on this side of the world, and of course many of the pieces in the Charles and Ray Eames collection. And then we're also going to be talking about a little bit of Alpine hospitality later as well. Marcus, you haven't managed to enjoy it too much. You missed our fantastic dinner at Cesavelia last night. As we were saying, you know, you were on the train. We kept on doing check-ins. But tonight we are going to, I'm taking you to Krone for dinner this evening, and we're having a proper fondue and raclette fest.
Ah, that's... I'm hungry already. I was meaning to ask from you, have you already eaten a carnadelli over here as well?
We have not. We had capons last night. And also our Ivan Carvalho, he had pizzoccheri. And pizzoccheri, of course, a rather rustic pasta from the region with potatoes and cheese and speck and all kinds of things on top.
Well, we can consider ourselves lucky because we are going to learn how to prepare carnadelli, a nice plate of carnadelli, later on this program. Our teacher will be Michelin star chef Norbert Niederkofler.
That's very nice. Sophie, you were about to say?
I've been eating barley soup all day.
Barley soup.
More or less exclusively barley soup.
And I shouldn't leave out, of course, our other guests are coming up, Marcus and Marinda Hauser, who are very much our hosts, as much as the Gemeinde, the local council here in St. Moritz. And, of course, they are the keepers of the menu, which you, or of course, of the recipe, which you mention as well. So much coming up. As I mentioned, Mr. Carl Elsner from Victorinox is here. He's going to join us after the break. You're listening to Midori House. We're live in St. Moritz, back right after this.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St. Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Home to almost every alpine cliché you can imagine, Switzerland's remote Lower Engadine has its own brand of old-fashioned charm. Monocle's film crew put on their snow boots to capture a world lost in time.
In earlier times, there was a clear hierarchy in the village. First of all came the priest, then the teacher, then the blacksmith. The one who controlled the fire, actually the master of the fire, that was then, in the belief of the people, a bit a higher person.
Mountain magic on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House live from St. Moritz in the heart of the Swiss Alps. Now, some of the famous, most famous products to come out of Switzerland are Swiss Army knives. And one family business and iconic Swiss brand, Victorinox, have been making them for centuries.
Victorinox has recently ventured into fashion. That would be in the form of outerwear, luggage and perfumes, and remains the only supplier of multi-purpose knives to the Swiss Army. CEO Carl Elsner, great-grandson of the founder, also named Carl Elsner as well, joins us now to explore the longevity of such an iconic brand and share his thoughts for the future of the business. Good evening and a very warm welcome.
Good evening.
It's great. You didn't have to travel very far. You're somewhat local at this time of year as well, so thank you for making the journey.
It's a pleasure.
Tell me, it's quite amazing. I'm going to share a very brief story with you. It was my birthday a couple of weeks ago. I have a friend who works at an airport in Canada, and she gave me for my birthday 44 mini Swiss Army knives, because at this particular airport in Canada, every Thursday, all of the staff at the airport, doesn't matter whether you're for airlines, etc., can go and buy all of the confiscated items. And so it was amazing. So she went and 44 of the mini versions with the tweezers and the toothpick, etc., and there they were. Now, when I thought about this, and she said, you know, it's not like there were just a few knives. She said that there are pailfuls and just bucket loads of Swiss Army knives.
Yep.
I don't want to talk about capitalizing on a very tragic event, but I think a lot of people must wonder, what happened to your business post-September 11th? Was this a boon for the business because so many people had to replace their knives? Or was it people saying, you know what, I'm never going to travel with it again, and that's why you diversified? I've always wondered, Mr. Elsner.
Okay. After September 11, it was one of the most difficult times for our company because globally sales dropped by more than 30%.
That's quite remarkable. And was that what forced, because if I think back, you know, well over a decade now, I think you have maybe slightly diversified your product mix at that time.
Yeah.
But it certainly wasn't as broad as it was today. Did that event force a slight rethink in terms of expanding the brand?
I think September 11 showed us in a very dramatic way how dangerous it can be when you depend on one product category. And after September 11, we really started to invest heavily in other product categories.
I should say, my brother, he has a Swiss Army knife, which he posts to himself every time we go on holiday. He posts it home. If he gets kind of stuck, you can get round it by the post. But it's quite interesting to see where your new market is and whether or not the knives are coming into fashion almost, and they're becoming an indispensable item for a younger generation. Talk about your sort of target audience and who these people are, the kind of new generation of Swiss Army knife owners.
I think still today when a young boy at the age of 7 or 8 receives his very first Swiss Army knives, you still today can see the stars in his eyes, and he's very happy and proud that his father or his mother puts trust in him and gives him a Swiss Army knife.
I actually do remember the Swiss Army knives from my childhood as well. I used to have quite a few. For some reason, I kept on losing them. I bet some of my friends actually may have taken some of them. But considering the long history of this company, when you decided to venture into some other areas, outerwear, luggage and perfumes, what kind of thinking did you go through when it came to this long heritage of the company and how it's being applied for these new products?
I think this still is today one of our big challenges, because the heart and the soul of our brand is the Swiss Army knife. And the values of the Swiss Army knives are really the high quality, the functionality, the iconic design. And our challenge today is to make sure that the new product categories like travel gear, like fashion, also are inspired by these values and are executed.
Can you just give me one example? For example, the perfumes, how do you see this inspiration there?
With the perfume, it's very interesting. When we started with the fragrance, we were also a little smiling, because we have seen on one side the functionality of the Swiss Army knife and on the other side the fragrance. But we were convinced that the fragrance will bring a new way, the passion and also some emotion to our new product line. And the team, our fragrance team, was very creative and, for example, created a fragrance that was covered by a soft shell, so when it drops on the ground, it doesn't break. And it has, like the Swiss Army knife, instead of the small ski ring, it has a little hook which you can hook on your belt or on your backpack.
That's perfect for you, Marcus. It's just what you need for the weekends.
Have you seen how bad I am with my perfume?
Now, Mr. Elsner, tell me, how important is Swissness? Because, you know, if I think of all of the countries in the world, I mean, some could argue maybe that the United States and the stars and stripes are slightly overused. But somehow Switzerland, with most Swiss brands, has done a pretty good job. And, you know, one would almost argue that former Swiss Air, current Swiss, the likes of Victorinox, have also done a very good brand of actually shaping Swiss global identity in many ways. So you must run in sort of a very fine line in how far you of course push Swissness and how you have to protect it as well. How many guardians are there in the company? Is it ultimately you, the CEO, who says, look, this is a brand extension too far for us, this is not something we should do, versus we need to stick to our values?
We have a brand team. My wife is also part of this brand team. And for us, it's really, as you have mentioned, we do not want to spread the brand too much. We want products that where we are able to really execute the values of the Swiss Army knives, and we want to invest in products that can become a companion for our customers, like the Swiss Army knife.
And how important is provenance to you? You opened your first store in Japan, for instance, in the 90s, and somewhere where it's very important where things are made. Is that still a focus for the business, and how much have you kept your production here in Switzerland?
I think globally, when you look at the Swiss Army knife, this is so strongly connected to the Swiss made that for us it's really not a question to ever think about producing the Swiss Army knife outside of Switzerland.
What about globally? Are there still many areas that you eye on with curiosity, areas that Swiss Army knives still haven't taken over?
When I look at the moment at our sales figures, I can see that especially in Asia, China, India are strong growing markets for us, and also some countries in South America like Argentina, Chile or Mexico.
I wondered, going back to Tyler's first point, this idea of knives and carrying knives, how do you sort of counter the negative connotations of having a knife in your pocket? And do you think that there's a message that you can put across, something a bit more utilitarian, something about these survival skills that are synonymous with the Swiss Army knife?
I think the this challenge of the growing, how do you call it, that there is more and more crime is a big challenge for Victorinox, because the Swiss Army knife, of course, it is made to help you in difficult situations. It has a screwdriver, a magnifying glass, a metal saw, wood saw, nail file and so on. But of course there is a blade and you can misuse a blade. And we have tried to make knives without blades, but in the market it was not successful, because still in the end people like to have the blade to cut their sausage or to cut an apple and so on.
Exactly. Well, Carl Elsner, CEO of Victorinox, many thanks for coming on the show this evening.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to this special edition of Midori House, live from a bustling terrace outside the Hauser Hotel in the heart of St. Moritz. We'll be back in just a moment to speak to the lady behind that most wintry of Engadine sporting activities, the white turf horse race on the icy surface of the St. Moritz Lake. Don't go away.
Before you set off on your travels this winter season, don't forget to pick up your issue of Monocle's winter newspaper, Monocle Alpino. We get cold weather combat training from Japan's elite snow patrols. We look at how Iceland has picked itself up and dusted itself off after a nasty wipeout. And we find the comfortable alpine retreats that will have you packing your bags and heading for the hills. Plus, we look at winter warming fashion ideas with all of the trimmings, including Bavarian Lederhosen. That's all in the current issue of Monocle Alpino. Prost und zum Wohl!
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sipitaler Brunet and Sophie Grove. One of the highlights of St. Moritz's winter is the white turf horse race that takes place on the St. Moritz See, the frozen lake St. Moritz. This is the tradition that started over 100 years ago, and the race is set to start again this coming February.
What gets even more attention at White Turf is the skikduring, a discipline unique to this event, in which men on skis are pulled along the ice track by unsaddled horses. Sounds incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, it's actually quite something to watch. I've seen it a few times. We're here to tell us more about the race and its history, and also about how you make sure the ice on the Lake of St. Moritz is thick enough to support the horses, the jockeys, the thousands of spectators, all of that catering, all of that champagne. We're joined by Elizabeth Zindel, General Secretary of the White Turf Racing Association. Welcome, and thank you for coming on to Midori House.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I want to go back. I think everyone is very curious about the logistics of making this happen. Just purely at a time when everyone thinks about global warming and perhaps frozen lakes getting thinner and thinner. What type of logistical exercise is it to make this happen? Because I've seen it, and I think for people probably listening, they think it's just a few horses racing around the lake. But I mean, this is really something far more.
Yes, it needs much more work. First of all, the ice must have at least 40 centimeters of thickness. Otherwise, it is not possible to build all these constructions on the lake. We have got about 3,500 square meters of tents, grandstands for about 3,500 people, and every Sunday there are about 11,000 spectators on the lake.
If you could just tell us in terms of the sequence of events, because it's not something which just runs for 1 week. I mean, the white turf is almost a season in and of itself. You know, we finish with Christmas here. We have Russian Christmas, which just seems to be the next event. And then really almost the white turf takes over next.
White turf is on the 1st, 2nd and 3rd of Sunday in February.
And in terms of the various events that happen, of course, we talked about the skikjoring that happens, but what are the other events in and around white turf as well?
It's flat racing and trotting races. Every Sunday, there are three flat races, two trotting races, and one skikjoring race.
I was looking at the lake yesterday with the wonderful Diana Conrad, who's written all about the history of this place, and especially the English involvement in sort of origins of some of these things. She's involved in the cricket on the ice, which happens at the same time. And I wondered if you could give us an insight into the origins of white turf, how it all came about.
Well, it's the first time they were thinking about a race was in 1906. When some people from St. Moritz, they started with a skiing race from the village out to Chamfer, which is next village, and back. But there were ordinary horses, no thoroughbreds. And then in 1907, they prepared the first race track on the lake and started with two or three races. And the year after, they already made about six races, but only skiing and trotting, no flat races. The flat races only started in 1911.
I'm still incredibly intrigued by all the logistics and about the ice. You said that the ice has to be at least 40 centimetres thick in order for it to be able to provide enough support for all the people and all the constructions there are on the ice. How do you make sure it is 40 centimetres? How much work do you need to do to check every single square metre of the ice?
They're going to drill some holes and then they can measure it. And there is also a system with radar measuring. But the usual thing is drilling holes and...
Have you had any problems with the global warming yet? Have there been occasions when you haven't quite got the 40 centimetres that is required?
Well, it depends.
I guess, how many times has it not happened because of thin ice? Or?
No, I think in all these 106 years it was abandoned, I think, two times.
Which is quite a remarkable feat, I think, when we think of everything that is going on right now.
But just for the conditions of the weather, not only because of the thickness or of the ice.
No, of course. Where do the other things, when we talk about sort of the peripheral things like the cricket and other things that we see, are these also affiliated things that sort of build around the white turf? Because, as I said, it really becomes an entire season throughout the February period.
Yeah, but the cricket is just in one small piece, not on the race course, and it doesn't... it's not attached to white turf.
And of course, yeah, everyone has to share the lake, I can imagine. And are there any particular highlights or any innovations? Because as you said, you're carrying on this sort of long tradition, but I think one always has to continue to innovate at the same time to make sure that sponsors still want to participate and be involved. So what can we look forward to at white turf this year?
For the sponsors, it's a highlight because they can invite their clients or guests. And we have got about tents. And on every Sunday, there are about 1,000 invited guests from the sponsors, from all the sponsors.
So it's a massive occasion taking place. Then quite looking forward to that. I'm quite tempted to return to Sunmori to see that with my own
more
eyes.
You're more than welcome to do so, Marcus.
That's a deal. Thank you very much, Elizabeth Zindel, General Secretary of the White Turf Racing Association. Thank you indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House live in Sunmori.
And coming up in the next half hour of the program, we find out how to cook a classic Dolomite dish with Michelin-starred chef. We assess the influence of Ray Eames on Alpine furniture design and sit down with Monocle's hosts in St Moritz, the dynamic hoteliers. The very lovely Marcus and Marinda Hauser have been taking very good care of us. That sounds like someone's car needs their transmission fixed or something like that over there. I think so. Aside from sort of learning about Dolomite dishes, some squeaky axles in and around. It's not that tight a roundabout in front of us, is it?
No, I think they could do with a little bit of tinkering in that engine. while we're chatting to the houses, maybe you could go and assist.
Yeah.
Marcus.
Well, you know, I think the car will go away probably in a couple of minutes, because now it's time for Jonathan Wheatley to give us the latest news headlines.
Marcus, thanks very much. The former South African President Nelson Mandela is doing well today after being discharged from hospital. The iconic statesman was admitted to Pretoria Hospital on the 8th of December, and this was his longest stay in hospital since he was released from prison back in 1990. Another former president is now in hosptital. Egypt's 84-year-old Hosni Mubarak, ousted last year after 30 years in power, was transferred to an army hospital from his prison clinic after fracturing a rib in a recent fall. India's Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has today pledged stringent action against perpetrators who brutally assaulted a 23-year-old medical student in a moving bus in New Delhi before throwing her half-naked outside. The Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy has today said that he did not rule out asking for help from the European Central Bank's bond-buying programme, but said Spain didn't expect to have to ask for aid for now. And President Barack Obama and congressional leaders are meeting today for the first time since November, with no sign of progress in resolving their differences over the federal budget and low expectations for a so-called fiscal cliff deal before the 1st of January. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. We're very much missing you over here in St Moritz. There's a perfect little director's chair perched at the end where I think you could deliver a lovely bulletin. Right now, it is just 3:32 in Nagano. It is 19:32 here in St Moritz. It's 13:32 if you're listening in Killington, Vermont. And why don't we say that it is, it's 10:32 if you're listening on the slopes of Blackcomb in British Columbia. Now, it seems that different partnerships contributed to the success of Vitra, the famous furniture house made in Switzerland. Willy and Erika Feilbaum founded Vitra at the beginning of the 1950s. The Vitra house is built by the two renowned Swiss architects, Herzog and Dumahon. And the great influence of the design couple Charles and Ray Eames was a fundamental force in its development.
The 15th of December of this year was dedicated to only one special person from Vitra's history, Ray Eames. It would have been her 100th birthday that day, and Vitra took this occasion to inaugurate a street named after her.
Well, Monocle travelled to the Vitra campus in Weil am Rhein to pop into the birthday party to celebrate her influence on alpine design. Eames Demetrius Ray's grandson explains what her anniversary means to the Eames family.
This date is a big deal for our family because our grandmother, Ray Eames, was a pretty amazing human being. She was better known to the world as a great designer, and she responsible for many of the most famous chairs of the 20th century, which are very beautiful and comfortable and still in production. But for us, she was our grandmother, and she just had an amazing heart and a great laugh and just infectious curiosity and life spirit. So she would have been 100 years ago tomorrow, December 15th. She was born in 1912. And so we've been figuring out ways to celebrate her and her legacy all around the world. And one of the, for me, sort of most captures the imagination is this idea of a street being dedicated in her honor. There's something about the whole process, and it had to be approved by the parliament of the local village. The mayor of the village was at the dedication ceremony, and there's a kind of formality to it that's really great because it's a big deal because it's going to be called, named after her for a long time. So they want to be sure she's somebody to name it after. And the mayor told us at the presentation that that it was unanimously consented. Nobody raised a single objection to it. And so think of that. She was born in Sacramento, California, a long way away from here. And it felt very natural for everybody to name a street after her. So that's pretty exciting.
The Vitra House in Weil am Rhein is the perfect location for this intimate get-together, where people are surrounded by the extraordinary work of her and her husband, Charles Eames. Rolf Feilbaum, who's the chairman of Vitra, explains the close relationship between the company and the couple who influenced Vitra's whole mindset.
Charles and Ray Eames were very, very important to Vitra. And they were, so to say, the sun around everything else is turning. And they were the beginning. And to today, they are the sort of the people who set the criteria that are ours when we think about design. They were the model of a designer and a type of author designer. So they are very much on my minds, both in terms of figures, but also their product is still a very important part of our production, and it's one of the miracles that it's still 50 years later, it's still modern. For the Eameses, it was the beauty didn't start when you, for a special occasion, when they did the picnic, when they did the table, everything was done in a beautiful way. And so even an experiment, which principally starts as a technical experiment, results in an object that is incredibly beautiful.
Vitra has a tradition to dedicate a street after the name of many great designers they work with. There's a Charles Eames Strasse, a George Nelson Strasse, and a Werner Pantonweg. The new street, Ray Eames Strasse, symbolically crosses Charles Eames Strasse before it leads up to the Vitra House.
It was high time because somehow unfairly we started, I think maybe 15 or more years ago, naming a street Charles Eames Street. And this was sort of looking at Charles only. We could have called it Charles and Ray Eames Strasse, which I think would have been more fair. And I think it took time also for us to realize the relevance of Ray's contribution. And this may be a late understanding. I mean, the understanding started like 10 or 12 years ago. An important part of it was the research that Joseph Giovannini did, in which he showed the influence of Ray as an artist on the design work, and especially the early work. And today, we feel it's the moment that should have been done a long time ago to represent Ray as well.
The acknowledgement of Ray's part in the couple's collaboration is not least owed to the research of the critic and architect Joseph Giovannini, who knew Ray personally. The essay he wrote for the Library of Congress shows that Ray was much more of an influence than many people assume.
There is a myth that one doesn't really know who did what in the Eames office, but when I was asked to do an essay for the Library of Congress for a catalog and a show that they did 10, 12 years ago, I set out to try to define what Ray Eames did in the office. My idea was to try to figure out what Ray knew and when she knew it, and what Charles Eames knew and when he knew it. And I, in order to do that, I went into the Library of Congress records and found something called Ray's trunk. Ray was a pack rat. She collected everything. She didn't throw anything away. And during the decade of the 30s, she went to every show, a modernist show in New York. She went to Indian dances. She was highly inquisitive, and she studied at length. She studied at length with Hans Hofmann, a very distinguished German painter who had lived in Paris from 1904 through 1914, who was a modernist. So what she finally brought to their collaboration was he knew how to make things, and she knew what was beautiful. And so there was a fusion of their two talents and their two expertises. So before my research, I think people really assumed that she was the wife, in some way who is professionally subordinate to the great man. But it turns out that she was a great lady at the same time. They had equal talents in slightly different spheres. So he was very good as the engineer, the architect who structured the problem, and she was very good at someone who gave imagery to a lot of the work that they did. She knew how to make things beautiful.
Joseph Giovannini, architect and critic, ending that report there. You're listening to Midori House. We're live in St. Moritz this evening. We'll be back right after this with a personal lesson in cuisine by the Michelin-starred chef Norbert Niederkofler. We'll be learning to make canederli, a Tyrolean dumpling. Don't go away.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St. Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick-and-span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero-emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sipitala Brule, and Sophie Grove. The time is 1942 here in St. Moritz, from where we bring you this very special edition.
For many, Christmas is a time to forget about one's figure and tuck in traditional foods, sweet and savoury. Today, we're going to learn how to make one such treat. And to do so, we're off to the mountains. No, not the Swiss Alps, but south to the Dolomites in Italy.
It's not just sweet and savory either. It's also rather alcoholic because we are tucking into the most delicious Glühwein, as we have been for most of these broadcasts so far. Nevertheless, Michelin star chef Norbert Niederkofler, who runs the St. Hubertus restaurant in Südtirol, is making us a plate of Knäderli, a classic Tyrolean dumpling. Our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho visited Niederkofler in his restaurant in the mountain village of San Cassiano.
So we're in the kitchen with Norbert Niederkofler of the St. Hubertus restaurant. Now, Norbert, you're going to be making Knäderli for us.
Yes, we're doing Knäderli with great cheese. So it's a very particular dish of Knäderli.
And Knäderli are dumplings?
Dumplings, this is dumplings. But this is the form here is different. Usually dumplings are round and this one are flat. And so they are not just cooked, but we sauteed them first.
Okay, walk me through the ingredients here.
So the ingredients are around 200 grams of dried bread from the day before, cut it in small cubes. Then we use half a white onion, just chopped very finely, and then saute with oil and with butter. Then we need around 125 milliliters of warm milk. We need 3 eggs. We need fresh chives, chopped very finely. And we need around 40-50 grams of grey cheese. It depends how ripe it is, because then it's it changes a lot the taste because it gets much stronger.
And this cheese is a special cheese from the area.
This is a special cheese from the area. This is the only slow food procedure from Südtirol cheese, and it's a very low fat cheese, so it's like in the beginning it's like a ricotta, and when you get ripe then it changes the color and it's got a very strong taste.
Okay, so now how do we start?
So we have the breadcrumbs, then we add the onions, we add the cheese, then we pour over the milk.
Now this is whole milk?
This is just this is whole milk, but it's just a little warm because then it melts much better. And now we mix it, start to mix it. And now we add 3 eggs, the whole eggs. So we add a little bit of salt, then some butter, some pepper, excuse me, and some more chive. So we do the dough now, we mix it really well, and then we let it rest for 15-20 minutes, and then we do the dumplings. And the fun thing, or the good thing about it, is you don't need any flour, because we don't cook them, just we saute them first, and so they get flat and we get them brown, nicely brown outside, and so it keeps together. So now we're making the dumplings. First we start to make them round like the usual dumplings, and then we make them flat like a hamburger. And this recipe, or this dish, is just especially a poor dish because it's made with leftovers. So it's with the milk, it's with great cheese, and it's with the old bread. And so it's a recipe which doesn't cost a lot of money, but it's really interesting. And then we serve it with cabbage.
And now you put it in the pan and with just some butter.
We put it in the pan with some butter. We saute them from both sides. Then we take them out and then we cook them in salted water.
So how long do they stay in the pan?
They just have to be crunchy on both sides. Just a couple of minutes. 1-2 minutes on one side, then we change, we turn them around, and then we have them 1-2 minutes on the other side. And the cooking we do in the water. Then they take around 9 to 10 minutes.
In the water, so the salted water needs to be boiling already?
Boiling, yes.
Okay, so Norbert, now you have some cabbage here?
Well, we have some cabbage. We cut it really in thin slices. Then the very important thing is that you should put a little bit of salt in right away. So, and then to really work the cabbage so it gets softer. Because otherwise it stays quite hard. Then you just let it rest for half an hour. And then before you serve it, we finish it with oil, but not with olive oil, with vegetable oil, because olive oil is too strong for the taste. And we use also some white wine vinegar and some cumin, that's it.
And this goes on the plate as a sort of a condiment with the Knäderli on top.
Yes, this goes on the bottom, then we serve the Canadian at the top. Now to set up the plate, we use the marinated cabbage, then we add the dumplings. And just to finish up the dish, we use some brown butter. Brown butter, we don't need a lot, we just need a little bit for the taste. So with the brown butter, you get those taste of a little bit of nuts, and it gets very fresh.
This is what kind of butter?
This is just butter from the farmer, from a local farmer. And then in the end, we put some fresh chives. That's one of our traditional dishes with which we use also, or which we eat also very often for Christmas.
Great. Thank you very much, Norbert. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thank you.
Norbert Niederkofler there with our Ivan Calvallo.
In a moment, we will welcome two of the figures at the center of the Samaritz après-ski scene, even pre-ski scene as well, because there's a very, very nice breakfast buffet here at Hauser's Hoteliers and, of course, Monocle's hosts in this town, Marcus and Marinda Hauser. But first, time for a bit of a seasonal song. He's already sort of been and gone, but anyway, you can never get enough Lena Horne. Santa Claus is coming to town, well, a year from now anyway.
I just came back from a lovely trip along the Milky Way. I call on dear old Santa Claus to spend coming to town. I have it on very good authority. In fact, I think it was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer who told me so.
Wonderful Lena Horne and Santa Claus is coming to town there.
You know, I have a theory about this, though, and we were discussing this on Christmas Eve, that Christmas music never got better than sort of, you know, the golden sort of post-war era, you know, and it kind of ended in the 1960s. The stuff that you really like, I mean, I know we play a bit of Michael Bublé and things like that. He can try as he might, but it's just, it's not the same.
No, even we had Mel Torme's son singing Mel Torme's classic tracks on the show, the Winter Series, and it just shows you how amazing and timeless those songs are.
No, absolutely.
My favourites. Now, you're listening to Midori House, broadcast live from snowy Samaritz, from the hustle and bustle of the Hauser Terrace outside the Hauser Hotel.
And we're very lucky enough to welcome the Hausers. It's certainly not the first time, because they've been taking very, very fine care of us for the last, actually, 5 or 6 days since we set up base. Marinda and Marcus are the Hausers. They're our hosts. And, of course, they've actually brought a beverage, which is sitting at the front of the table. Marcus, I'm going to turn it over to you first to tell us what is this little concoction that you've poured for us this evening?
In this little glass. Good evening.
Good evening.
Great that we can be here with you.
No, thank you for having us. Amazing.
So I brought a little cold drink, which is warming up from inside to the outside. We need that. It's freezing temperature. I brought the King's Ginger. King Edward already at the time drank that, we discovered and make hot drinks with the base of King's Ginger. You had it on Thursday, I think, and now this time we have it as a in a little glass, just pure.
Okay, well, we've got 7 minutes left on this program, so it'll certainly fortify us. Thank you. Thank you very much for hosting us. Zum Wohl.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Clink,
clink. I have to sort of like do a very, very far reach. Cheers.
Cheers.
Clink.
Great.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite nice. That you could do many nice cocktail with that. I want to ask you, Marcus, the role that this hotel plays. You know, we had Mr. Wiedemann on from the Palace, which is a very different type of property from what you are doing. I mean, this property, doesn't matter whether I'm here in the summertime, and certainly at this time of year, I mean, your dining room absolutely hums from first thing in the morning. How do you sort of see yourself positioned here? Yes, you're part hotel. You're almost sort of part community center in a way. You've got all of course, looking across the way, many a ski instructor. You've become their unofficial hostel when they come down from the slopes. How do you see your role in Samaritz?
Yeah, the Hauser is in the center, as you said, and I try to bring the business forward. I try to bring new ideas in and to fill the restaurant and the hotel and the terrace, especially the terrace in winter and summer. I try to make the best out of it and then bring guests in the morning and midday and evening during 320 days a year, almost the whole year. We have to close in November a little bit to renovate and to make the business even better. I try to find out new ideas. I try to do a lot of events to push the restaurants, and we have the best place, the best position in town, so you have to do something out of it.
Mirinda, I wanted to bring you in here because I've been lucky enough to be in your kitchen, and you run the confectionery side of the business, which is quite a feat. Now, I've seen your kitchen downstairs, incredible vats of chocolate down there. Can you tell me that side of things and how important that is to the Hauser brand?
It also, it has to do with the history of the family Hauser, of course, because the Marcus's father and the grandfathers, they were all patisserie chefs. And of course, they brought this then to St. Moritz, and we've continued the tradition. We still use all the traditional recipes as well, and it's a nice little adjacent to the restaurant and into the hotel, so we can do a lot of the desserts and so on into the restaurant.
It really sort of seems though that there's two entrances, or there's multiple entrances of the hotel, then into the restaurant, and then of course into the confectionery as well. Where is the balance and the tension? Because I see a lot of people just coming in to buy their bread. They're just coming in to buy their sweets, and then they head off back to their apartment or their chalet, and maybe they don't have a relationship with the rest of the property. There are probably some people who just want to come in and have a very good Senin roasty as well. So where is the tension between hotel, restaurant, and the confectionery business, do you think?
I don't know if there's
I know if that's a political question or not. I know there might be a punch-up. Who knows?
There is no tension at all.
There's no tension.
We try just to keep tradition. Yeah. As Mirinda said, we come from the sweet side, pastry making, from Schwarzwald first, and then to Zurich, and then up to St. Moritz. 57 years ago, we started here with the coffee shop and pastry making. We keep that, and we try to bring it forward and keep it up. And then, as I said, we try to bring the restaurant forward and to bring the hotel keep the hotel on a great level and a three-star level. So it's difficult to describe, but we try just to keep it up and to be here for many kinds of guests.
I wanted to come in and ask you about that sort of historical side of things, because it looks very modern and it's a fantastic, wonderful concrete structure, but there is a wealth of history that you're preserving. I wanted to give us an insight into the history of the Hauser Hotel.
Quickly,
very quick. We had the two-story building. You cannot see it on the radio, but we put on 1973 more stories on pylons on top of the old building, and that in just 8 months. The architecture is quite unique, as we are at the house. Several offers. The uniqueness is the pylons, and Mr. Robert Obrist is the architect who built that house in 8 months. It was superb that he could do that, and we have now 80 beds.
And it's an absolutely fantastic property, and I want to thank you very, very much for hosting all of us here. Marcus and Mirinda Hauser, many thanks for that. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment. And that is pretty much all the time we have for today. I want to thank our producer, Alan John, our researcher, Manon Spindler, in our Zurich bureau. Jack Phillips has been, of course, manning the desk here on the Swiss side. Toby Hammond is back in London. And Isabel Kayser is the one who's been running everything else. News is next. And, of course, we then have a very special Christmas special of the menu. We're going to be back tomorrow at 1300 Central European time with the review. But now for me, Tyler Brulé.
It's Sophie Grove.
And from me, Marcus Hipp.
Have a very, very lovely weekend. We'll say good evening from St. Moritz. And of course, the full cast and crew is back here, of course, on Monday. Schönes Wochenende. Bye-bye.